welcome to part three of our three-part series on the war in Italy in 1943 and 1944. Today we'll be wrapping up with the Battle of Monte Cassino. We had an interview with Matthew Parker, which is great. I have always been fascinated with the Battle of Monte Cassino, mainly because I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a battle that featured so many nations and so many different people, mainly with the Allies. You know, over the course between January and May of 1944, Americans, British, New Zealanders, Polish, French, Indians, Gurkhas, Maoris from New Zealand fought and tried to take the town of Monte Cassino and the area surrounding there. So I've always been, you know, interested in, because you just had so many different people from so many different parts of the globe that fought in one place. Not that they fought all together, but again, it was just this specific place that featured so many different parts of the Allied war effort, ranging from, you know, citizen soldiers from America to exiled Polish who had their homeland taken in 1939, to New Zealanders who were fighting in Europe all the way across the globe, to the Gurkhas from India, which were some of the best Allied soldiers that ever fought in the war. So again, I think it's always just fascinating to kind of look at this specific battle, because again, you had this kind of climactic battle over a period of 4 months that was really the main focus of the war in Italy, as well as Anzio. But it's always, I think, really interesting to look at. So without further ado, we'll get to the interview and to the Battle of Monte Cassino. On our final episode of the Italian campaign series, we welcome on Matthew Parker. He is the author of several history books, including Hell's Gorge, The Battle of Britain, and Monte Cassino, which we'll be talking about today. His most recent book, published in August, tells the extraordinary story of Willoughbyland, the forgotten 17th century English colony in Sardinia, which was exchanged with the Dutch for New York. He also recently elected to be a fellow of the Royal Historical Society. So welcome on.
Thank you.
And to start, what is your favorite subject of history to research and talk about? Why is your favorite, and how did you become interested in the Battle of Monte Cassino?
Well, I grew up in England in the 1970s, and the Second World War was somehow everywhere. All the comics, all the films. There was a series of sort of magazines and called Commando magazines, which had these sort of very heroic versions of the war, usually with some sort of class twist so that the lieutenant would win the respect of the null sergeant and this sort of thing. And it was kind of all around us. And I was sort of read everything about the Second World War. And that really led me to write about it. And then I wrote Monte Cassino, and then I decided I don't want to write about the Second World War anymore. And my other big interest, and really what I've taken forward in my writing career, is sort of the empire race, and particularly the Caribbean, where I lived as a teenager. My dad worked for Shell, and he was posted out there. So I lived for 4 years in Barbados. And obviously, for the first weeks or months, you just look around going, wow, I'm living in paradise. The rum, the beaches, the water sports, everything, the music. And then you look around a bit more and think, this is a really strange place. What are all these people doing here? Who owns stuff? And that really got me interested in Caribbean history and then the wider British Empire, which obviously is a very important subject for British people now, and always has been and will be for a long time, I think. So I kind of started with the Second World War and then moved on to the British Empire.
And what are some of the challenges that you have encountered, whether it's been writing about, you know, Second World War or about Caribbean history?
Well, I think with the Second World War, you have to... you know, there's a divide between people who've been in combat and people who haven't. And people who haven't, like myself, thank goodness, you know, there is a sort of, you know, imaginative bridge and sympathetic bridge to cross. When writing about the empire, the massive, massive challenge is finding the voices of the colonized rather than the colonizer. You know, so much of the literature, for obvious reasons, I mean, I've been writing recently about the history of the Pacific Islands, and the pre-literate societies, and you to find a voice of, you know, saying from the other side is a massive challenge for historians of empire and race as well.
And to get into the Battle of Monte Cassino, which we'll be talking about today, to cover some of the events leading up to it, what influence did the Casablanca Conference have on the decision to invade Sicily and then in aftermath invade Italy?
Well, the Casablanca Conference in January 43 really sort of stemmed from the decision taken a few months earlier to commit sizable Allied forces to North Africa. Roosevelt, when America joined the war in December 41, was really keen, really for political reasons, and this will be a recurring theme of our conversation, I'm sure. For political reasons, he was extremely keen to commit American troops to fight the Germans as quickly as possible. Obviously, the Russians are facing 150 German divisions on the Eastern Front, and Marshall, you know, obviously the top military commander at the time, and a lot of the other senior military commanders were dead against it. They, you know, they went with Clausewitz. We should just hit, you know, the direct route to Berlin as quickly as possible. But that wasn't feasible in 42 because of the lack of landing craft, and there weren't enough American trained troops in the theater. So he committed to the torch landings in November 42, and that really sort of drove the process forward. So you've suddenly got all of these Allied troops, they're beating the Germans in North Africa, and the Italians obviously as well. And what to do next? And again, the Americans were, it was really fiery negotiations. The Americans were really suspicious of the British intentions. The British wanted to stay in the Mediterranean. They wanted, Churchill had an idea to set the Balkans alight, or do something with Sicily or Italy. And he won that argument. But the legacy of that was deep distrust between the key allies of the United States and the United Kingdom. The United States felt they were like they were serving an imperial purpose, because of course the route to India and the empire is a massive concern of Churchill's. And for the Americans, it's, you know, they don't want to fight for the British Empire. That's the last thing they want to support. So there was this legacy of mistrust that came from that. But the decision was made, of course, to invade Sicily.
And after the invasion of Sicily, and then later arriving in Italy after the breakout of Salerno, as the Allies arrived in the area around Monte Cassino, what were some of the key features that the Allies would have to take in order to kind of break through what has now sort of become known as the Gustav Line?
Well, the thing about this decision taken in Casablanca, Sicily, it didn't even include Italy. The idea of invading Sicily was to hopefully knock Italy out of the war, which it succeeded in doing. Of course, Mussolini fell, you know, before Italy was even invaded. And then there was a question of sort of keeping going for political reasons, just to keep engaging the enemy. This is the Allies' only active front against the Germans. And it was a strategic idiocy. I mean, Italy is famously described, I mean, Napoleon described it, it's a boot. You enter from the top. And the idea of fighting up towards Rome from the south made no strategic or tactical sense, because there's steep mountains, there's fast-flowing rivers. It's a defender's paradise. And of course, the Cassino feature itself, the anchor of the Gustav Line, had been studied for generations as the most perfect defensive spot in Europe. So the Allies couldn't have chosen a harder task for themselves. Add to that, terrible, terrible Italian winter. You know, the troops said, we're off to sunny Italy. It was anything but. It was freezing cold, which meant, and there was heavy rain, snow, which meant that the Allies' huge superiority in tanks and aircraft was totally meaningless. A mule was worth 20 tanks. And you've got these winding roads, perfect for defensive demolitions, mines, and it was a terrible, there was a huge collapse in purpose and morale even before the Allied army got to Monte Cassino. By the time they arrived there in sort of late December, early January, there was something like 20,000 British troops had deserted, to the extent that General Alexander, who was the supreme Allied commander, tried to persuade Churchill to reimpose the death penalty for desertion in the British Army, which had been abolished. And the Americans, they had something like 20,000 casualties and 50,000 men off sick. I mean, these are armies in morale collapse. And that's even before the nightmare of Casino.
And to get into the sort of what is called now the First Battle of Monte Cassino, was the disaster at the Rapido River a sign of difficulties that, you know, both the Americans and in general the Allies were going to be faced over the next couple of months trying to break through the Gustave Line?
I think the Rapido River disaster, Bloody River as it's known, really tells us a few different connected things. I mean, at the time, of course, it was described as the worst military disaster since Pearl Harbor for the Americans. And it was a total, total fiasco. One of the factors is raw, untrained troops. A lot of the people there in Walker's 36th Texas Division were replacements. There was no feeling, because they'd been wiped out the division had been wiped out a couple of times before they even got there. And a lot of them, they were attacking across a minefield in the dark, flooded, carrying heavy boats to try and cross a river. And a lot of them just threw down their weapons and quit. A lot of them shot themselves in the hand. And as one veteran said to me, you know, if you shoot yourself in the hand with, you know, an assault rifle, your whole hand is blown off. And so that's one factor, that the American troops were not of very good quality. There's no other way to put it. And another factor is General Mark Clark, whose idea this was. And Walker, the general of the 36th Division, mistrusted him and didn't want to go ahead, but had to. And I think it also, it sort of points an accusing finger at Mark Clark, who was actually, there was a congressional investigation after the war into the Bloody River, for which he was exonerated for some reason. But, you know, you talk to veterans, and which is really what this book is about. It's about me talking to veterans. And a lot of them have this affection for their commanding officer, however bizarre that may seem. Not Clark. No one had a good word to say about Clark. The other factor, which is also sort of keeps going through the Monte Cassino story, is sort of recriminations. Because in theory, the British, they crossed the Garigliano River down towards the coast. And they were supposed to also cross to try and outflank the German positions facing where the Americans were going to cross. And they didn't. They didn't succeed. And according to the Americans, they didn't really try very hard. So there's all these recriminations. And all these things continue. The lessons of Rapido River weren't really learned. And so then you have this sort of senseless slaughter going on for months.
And while this was, you know, the Rapido River disaster went on, there was this idea to land behind the German lines at Anzio. Was there an expectation that this landing would make it easier for the Allies to break through the Gustav Line?
Very much so. I mean, the Allies had total air and naval superiority. And, you know, the land of Italy, they could have, you know, this was a real worry for the Germans that they could, the amphibious landings could come behind their lines at any time. It's worth noting, though, that amphibious landings are one of the most difficult things to do in a war. And Salerno was very nearly failed. They got away with that by the skin of their teeth. So there's a lot of trepidation. And what happened with Anzio, the idea was they would land behind and that would break the Gustav Line. They would have to retreat in order to avoid being encircled. But what actually happened is the American General Lucas, Clark had a little, we're back to Mark Clark again, had a little word in his ear and said, don't be too rash. You know, we've had Salerno really nearly went wrong. Just be very careful. And he was. And the other thing that Lucas and Clark talked about, said, the idea of this is Churchill. This is Churchill's idea. He's the architect of Gallipoli, and we all know how that ended up. So Lucas lands, and he just reinforces the perimeter. He doesn't sort of rush inland to encircle the German 10th Army. And Churchill described it. He said, I thought we were going to land a roaring tiger on the beach, and instead we have a beached whale. And then he got a report that something like 18,000 vehicles had been landed in this tiny pocket, and Churchill said, we must have a great superiority of chauffeurs. So it was a huge frustration. And then what happened? And this is a big factor in why the casino battle had to continue, is that they feared counterattack. The Germans are obviously very, very good at very effective counterattackers. And so instead of Anzio saving Cassino, the soldiers at Cassino had to keep attacking all through this appalling winter weather in order to relieve Anzio. So the tail was wagging the dog.
And eventually the first units to arrive around the Cassino area were Americans under the U.S. 34th Infantry Division. Do you think an opportunity was missed to kind of break through Cassino before the Germans could, you know, fully reinforce it? Or were kind of expectations too high for Allied commanders in Italy?
I think the real opportunity lost was with the French attack. The French were attacking on the right flank through the mountains. And they had these superb troops from the mountains of North Africa, from Morocco and Tunisia and Algeria. And they made sensational progress. They broke the Gustav line in the first battle, but they weren't reinforced. I hate refighting battles. It's not my style at all. But had they been reinforced, it would have been a completely different story. But no one trusted the French. The French had folded in 1940, no one trusted the French. We're back to this inter-allied rivalry and mistrust that dominates the story. And as far as the 34th Division, they got lucky because they crossed the Rapido up from slightly upriver from where Bloody River had happened. And thick fog descended. And so they were able to make their way up the Massif and onto this ridge overlooking the monastery. And really, it was a fantastic achievement. But then once they were up there, they were almost impossible to supply. And you couldn't dig in because it's rocky terrain. So all they could do was pile stones around them and keep their heads down. Meanwhile, freezing, uncramped. And it was a very, very difficult experience for them, as other Allied troops would find in the same spot later on in the campaign.
And to get into the Second Battle of Monte Cassino, which, you know, is now called, as the Americans kind of pulled out, the New Zealand Second Corps arrived at the Cassino area. What units were a part of this military formation?
Well, this was a sort of multinational force. I mean, I think something like 17 different nationalities were fighting at Cassino. On both sides, there was a huge range of nationality, which is very interesting. And I look at it in the book and, you know, the different backgrounds to these people, why they thought they were there, what they were doing, their attitudes. But this is a crack units. You've got a New Zealand division, and you've got an Indian division, and you've got slightly later on the 78th British Battle Axe Division, who had covered themselves in glory in North Africa. And the Indian division, like all Indian divisions in the British Army, had it was two-thirds Indian, officers by British, and one British brigade. So three brigades, two of which were Indian and one of which was... and they were... The theory was that they would be the people who would take the monastery.
And can you kind of... There was a debate over what to do over this abbey that overlooked the area. Can you walk us through kind of the decision-making process that ultimately led to the bombing of the abbey? Was there a serious debate over this decision? And do you think it helped the Allies in any way?
This is one of the... I don't know, you can't... How many great tragedies are there? But this was a sort of... an absolutely shocking act of destruction. One of the places, the birthplaces of European civilization. It's where all the classical, surviving classical texts were translated. It was incredibly full of priceless works of art. But if you go to Cassino and you stand underneath it and you look, there's this spur of land that rises out of the valley and perched on top of these thick walls. It was built like a fortress because, you know, monasteries had to be fortresses back in the, you know, the 16th, 17th century. And for soldiers down below, it cast this sort of spell on them. And they were convinced that there were eyes watching them from the monastery, from the high monastery walls. Because, of course, this is a time where artillery spotters are probably the most important people in either army. And in fact, there weren't any Germans in the monastery, but they decided that it had to be bombed in order that the New Zealand, the Indian troops of New Zealand division could then rush down from the positions won by the Americans and take this crucial feature from where you could, from the monastery, if you stand up there on the wall, the whole area is laid out like a map. It's a superb, you know, observational position. But what actually happened is somewhere along the lines, the everything got a bit out of control. And this is partly inter-service rivalry. The United States Air Force, the SPATS, decided, right, this is a great moment for me to demonstrate the power at my disposal. So he sent in these waves and waves of flying fortresses and absolutely obliterated the building. Also obliterated quite a few of the Allies who were, you know, and there was a hospital, there was, more people at casino. Allies and civilians were killed by the American Air Force than by the Luftwaffe. This is an inexact science. So they just plastered the whole place with bombs. But no one had told the waiting Indian troops that this was going to happen. So they weren't in position to attack at the right moment while the Germans were still, you know, you want to be behind the barrage as close as you can. And it's just one of these things that I discovered, you know, researching this and talking to the veterans, most of all. It's chaos, it's confusion. No one knows what they're supposed to be doing. That's the reality of war. It isn't, you know, let's move this piece here and move that piece there. So they weren't ready. And the destroyed monastery actually made a better defensive position than the intact monastery in terms of field of fire, in terms of artillery support and everything else. So it was a complete waste of time, effort, bombs, and the destruction of this cultural monument.
And did the press play any role in the debate over the bombing of the Abbey, or was it exclusively a military decision?
Obviously, the press weren't consulted before the decision was made. But afterwards, there was the Air Minister, Lord Simon, stood up in the House of Lords and defended the bombing. There'd been international criticism. And you speak to Italians, even now at Casino, who were there at the time. They go, we will never forgive the Allies for doing this to our monastery. And there was outrage, particularly amongst the Catholics and so on. And Lord Simon stood up in the House of Lords and said, well, actually, you know, the monastery wasn't that great. Most of it was 19th century. Most of the frescoes, the priceless Renaissance frescoes, most of them were painted by German artists, you know, this kind of thing. And then I actually looked, for the senior criticisms, I looked at the Times and they reported it, you know, They entirely approved. They said this was a German stronghold. So it's the German fault for making it into a stronghold, which they didn't. In fact, it was full of Italian refugees, you know, all of whom got obliterated.
And did General Bernard Freiberg, who was in charge of the New Zealand Second Corps, did he take a different approach to trying to take Casino? Was it different from how the Americans tried to do it, or was it largely the same?
We're still on the second battle. For the second battle, it was largely the same. It was, attacking. He sent his Maori brigade into the town to try to capture the station, which they nearly did, but they were driven back. And then he sent his Indian and the Royal Sussex Battalion across this ridge called Snake's Head Ridge that overlooks the monastery. But the Germans had. The point is they'd had months to prepare the Casino position, and they were really, really good at this. So they had guns on set lines, you know, everywhere, which was a potential way forward, was mined or booby-trapped. And again, as we said earlier, they were very good at counterattacking. So one position, the notorious Hill 593, which is now host to a monument to the Polish soldiers, That changed hands about five times over the course of the fighting, but remained in German hands after the second battle. And this was a key position. You couldn't advance without being spotted from it and come under fire.
And was a big problem that faced the Allies throughout the battle the terrain, meaning they could only attack with so many men and tanks despite, you know, heavily outnumbering the Germans throughout the area?
Yeah, I mean, I think the weather is another huge factor. As we said earlier, there was very little, very little ways in which the Allies could assert their or make use of their overwhelming superiority in aircraft. And the same happened. The same was with tanks, because one of the defensive measures the Germans had taken was to dam the river and then let it flood. So the whole of the area in front of Casino Town and the monastery was a marsh, and you drive a tank into it and you get stuck and you'd be a sitting duck. So they couldn't use their overwhelming superiority. And also, once, I mean, we're probably sort of onto the third battle. Once Freyberg decides to put his main thrust into the Casino Town, after another massive bombing, there was a huge carpet bombing of the town, and that just meant that it was unpassable, not just for tanks, but for men as well. And men, again, would be filed, because of all the wrecking, would be filed into narrow lines of attack, which, and therefore were easily repulsed. So it didn't, if anything, the superiority in aircraft and artillery and everything else was actually a handicap, because it just meant even more friendly fire casualties for the Allies.
And on the flip side, I know in your book you explored sort of the German perspective. What was sort of the makeup of the Germans who were fighting against the Allies in this area? And was it generally difficult for the Germans to supply these troops in the front line?
Well, I was very struck by, you know, we've said that the Allied force had 10 different nationalities from all over the world, all over the empire, from America. There was a Japanese brigade from the United States that were fighting. There were Maoris, there were Gurkhas, Indians, all of all descriptions. And the German side was surprisingly sort of mixed as well. They were, you know, Germans, Austrians, forcibly or not conscripted Poles, French, Czechs. There were Russians working behind the lines as support troops. But again, in terms of supply, the Germans had plenty of time to sort this out. They had sort of blasted tunnels and caves throughout the mountains. And also they were able at night, because of the sort of deep ravines, they were able to bring up supplies at night. During the day, no one could move, because then if they were Allied aircraft, they'd get hit. But they were able to keep their lines pretty well supplied, yes. And there was one standout unit on the German side, which was the parachute division, which is traditionally sort of one of the more sort of Nazified units, you know, sort of really ardent nationalist Nazi. And it was their job, you know, Hitler had abandoned parachuting after the losses in Crete, but their job was to defend the town against the New Zealand attack in the third battle. And they became known as the Green Devils of Casino. And it was a huge propaganda boost for the Germans back at home. And they said, we'll fight like this, we can still win this war. So, you know, there's all this sort of politics and propaganda going on at the same time, which again puts extra pressure on the British commanders to get the job done, even though the timing was clearly, you know, was clearly very bad.
And would you say the failure of these experienced soldiers from, you know, New Zealand and India to take Casino impacts, you know, Allied morale kind of across the line? Did it kind of, you know, impact, you know, Allied expectations for invading Italy? I mean, what had kind of happened after the Second Battle of Monte Cassino kind of came to an end?
Well, one of the things, actually probably the one thing more than ever that brought me to want to write this story. I was working on a book. Before I was a sort of full-time writer, I did editing and ghostwriting and sort of structural edits, book doctoring, you call it. And I worked with this guy called Ben Shepherd, who wrote a book quite a few years ago called War of Nerds, which is an absolute classic, and I recommend it to all of your listeners. And it's about military psychiatry. And it starts in the American Civil War, the First World Industrial War, and it sort of traces the way in the Civil War, if people broke down, it was known as soldier's heart. And then in the First World War, of course, it's shell shock, because of this erroneous idea that it was reverberation from the shell, and it had this psychological effect, making people hysterical and shaking and nightmares and sweat. And then in the Second World War, it's called battle exhaustion, I think. You know, as if it's just, oh, you're a bit tired, mate, come on, put yourself together. And then, of course, Vietnam, PTSD gets invented, and it's a very uncynical, it's sympathetic, but very, very sort of balanced. You know, it points out that the moment you invent a disease, everyone with any sense in the front line suddenly got it, And, you know, once they know the symptom, suddenly they've got the symptom. You know, there's this really interesting thing. But one thing really stuck on me from this book, and he talks about how young American psychiatrists who've been in Africa, fast-moving campaign, but because Casino is suddenly with this static, you know, it's the most static battle. And for that reason, they were able to go right up to the front line and for the first time. And what they saw there completely shocked them. They saw virtually everyone in a rifle company was exhibiting in the front line the same symptoms, sweat, nightmares, shakes, that they were treating at the psychiatric hospitals behind the line. And another senior American psychiatrist also really observed this, was able to observe this static situation, and said that anyone in a frontline unit, unless they get wounded, will become a psychiatric casualty. It's certain. And I was like, what is going, you know, is this a mass nervous breakdown happening here? You know, what is going on? And that really sent me out in my car and on, you know, traveling all around the world to interview the veterans and ask them what on earth was going on. And you could see that, you know, we talk about morale, but, you know, there was a huge frustration. At the same time, these guys knew that this wasn't D-Day. They knew that D-Day was coming. They were the D-Day dodgers. That's how they were described back in England. So they're in a secondary campaign that is absolute hell on earth. And they're getting, you know, wiped out psychologically and physically. You know, hardly anyone, I don't think anyone I spoke to, of all the veterans, escaped without injury. You know, this is an absolute charnel house.
And so we experience kind of the struggles that the New Zealanders, Indians, kind of faced trying to take Casino. By the time the Corps was preparing for, you know, another assault on the Casino area, was this largely in part to keep away German attention from Anzio, even though, you know, they knew that it was probably going to be another failure due to the kind of the weather and all these other factors?
I don't know whether they knew it was going to be a failure. I think that's certainly, like we said, Anzio was, you know, driving tactics at Casino in a way that was, you know, was very destructive for the chance of success. It wasn't just Anzio, it was also the wider political situation. As I said, this is the only active front. The Battle of Kursk is happening. You know, it's looking, you know, Stalin is putting huge pressure on Roosevelt and Churchill to do more, you know, to get across the Channel and engage, take some of the heat away from the Red Army, who are obviously facing, you know, exponentially more powerful forces than the Allies were in Italy. So, Church, like he said, there was a great need to keep engaging them, even if, you know, the outcome is not a guaranteed success or not even a likely success. So there's a wider political mess going on that is driving policy on the ground at Casino.
And when the Allies launched, you know, another attack aimed at trying to take the town of Casino, was most of the fighting in this area kind of urban in the town itself?
Yeah, I mean, it was a real sort of modern urban battle where groups of enemy soldiers, there could be just a wall separating them from houses. There's all sorts of things going on in cellars and trying to drive through. And it's a real sort of, you know, it's sort of grenades and hand-to-hand fighting. And, you know, as I said, the German defenders, even though, you know, a load of them had been destroyed in this incredible, incredibly fierce carpet bombing of the town, enough survived to drive the New Zealanders back. And fighting continued for many days, and the casualties rose and rose. And eventually Freyberg, who was a Victoria Cross winner from the First World War, just said one word, looked at the battle ground and just said one word, Passchendaele. It's over. Let's get the survivors out of there.
And, you know, by the end of March, had another stalemate occurred in the area, and was the 2nd New Zealand Corps pulled off the line?
Yeah, they were taken and they were replaced by, because the 8th Army had been fighting up the eastern side of Italy, and weather had sort of, and flooding had really sort of made that a sort of, you know, it really shut down campaign. So Alexander moved some units over from there. to join the casino, and yeah, the New Zealanders, what was left of them, were moved back behind the line.
Would you say that kind of throughout these months of, you know, constant attack, despite kind of the failure to break through, had the Germans been pretty weakened by kind of the constant fighting and the difficulties of trying to challenge, to resupply their troops, given kind of the Allied air superiority?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I think I say in the book, for every shell that Krupp sent over, General Motors sent over 10, you know. But the Germans were very well dug in. And like I said, they had a lot of time to have concrete, steel-reinforced shelters. They had reasonable supply lines. They did, one thing that did, well, a couple of things on the sort of, on the strategic and on a tactical level. On a tactical level, the success in the first battle of the British crossing the Garigliano down by the coast had drawn some German reserves away from the Anzio landing. So that had sort of succeeded, and that helped with Anzio. And in the sort of wider strategic picture, there were units moved from the Eastern Front just before the Battle of Kursk to Italy to reinforce. So in terms of, you know, what was the purpose of the campaign? To tie down the Germans. Okay, well, it tied down many more Allied troops, but the Allies had more troops. So that's really the only strategic sort of plus you can really take from the Italian campaign, that a couple of good German divisions and good German generals were moved from the Eastern Front, which may have made a tiny difference to the fortunes of the Red Army.
And one unique perspective, I think, that kind of goes on in one of the final battles at Monte Cassino was the Polish troops that were there. As they moved in, what was kind of the makeup of this unit, and how did these men end up in Italy, of all places?
Well, that's it's an extraordinary story, and it's just in itself. When the Russians and the Germans sort of divided Poland between them in 1939, all the prisoners of war that the Russians took, something like 50,000 men. I mean, as we all know, the officers were taken off and shot and murdered. But the bulk of the men and their families were shipped, or put onto sort of good trains, and they rumbled east for 3 weeks beyond the Urals, where they were set to work in basically a gulag. They were set to work in mines and forestry and so on in appalling conditions. But eventually, the British government, sort of really nagged by the Polish government in exile in London, got them released. Stalin agreed to release them, and they were sent down through Iraq, and they were re-equipped, they were rested, they were fed, they were cleaned up, and they were put in uniform, and they were very, very keen to fight the Germans, probably more than any other group fighting at Cassino. Most of whom, you know, if you're looking at American and British, these are civilians in uniform. These aren't, you know, and they, you know, so many I spoke to never even fired their rifles or fired anything. You know, they just didn't. I mean, Americans famously, they had to set up hate camps to teach them to hate the Germans enough to actually want to kill them. I'm not Japanese, but they have no problem with killing. And the Poles were different. They had scores to settle with the Germans. And where the Americans or the British would probably sort of creep into position, the Poles had marched in, you know, took up and just started attacking. Often in a completely militarily, you know, ineffectual, and you know, a lot of it was just a waste. But they were burning with hatred, and they were given, I think, probably for political reasons as well, they were given this rather sort of. You have to think the publicity is all, you know, publicity is constantly. I mean, Clark famously had 50 people working for him in his PR department. The Allies decided the Poles should have the honour of capturing the monastery. And they attacked, and just got killed and killed and killed. And eventually the Germans abandoned it and the Poles marched in unopposed. But it's still, and I mean, this is something when I first started researching, but I hadn't really picked up on, that for Poland, this is a really important national moment. And in occupied Poland, people started putting, daubing Monte Cassino on the wall. This is a symbol that Poland was still free and fighting. And of course, it wasn't. And hardly any of the Poles who fought at Cassino ever went back to Poland. Because why would they want to go back to Poland under Stalin, you know? So it was all for nothing. But when I was there, I spent a lot of time there, as I'm sure you can imagine. I was sitting in the Polish cemetery one day, And suddenly these bus coaches all arrive and outpour all of these Polish people, and they're on a pilgrimage to the site. And there's priests who get out the start giving out sacrament. There's guitarists singing patriotic songs. You know, it's just, for them, it's, you know, the most important battle of the Second World War by a long way, for purely symbolic reasons.
And by the time that Polish troops eventually took kind of the abbey and casino, was there anything left of the town or the monastery, or was it pretty much all rubble?
The monastery was pretty much destroyed. I mean, the base of the, they had this huge thick walls, and the base of those walls and bits of it were still there. The town was another story. Now, if you go there now, there is not a single building in the whole of the casino town that predates that carpet bombing in 1944. Not a single building. It was utterly flattened. It's, you know, an extraordinary place to visit. And, you know, and all around these massive graveyards, the German, the British, the Canadian, the American. It's an extraordinary place and very moving place to visit, as I'm sure you can imagine.
And, you know, eventually, you know, after months and months of attack, the Allies broke through the Gustav Line. The Allies at Anzio eventually broke out, and Rome was eventually taken. But my final question is, you know, what do you think the legacy of the Battle of Monte Cassino ultimately is?
Well, I think it's worth mentioning that the fourth battle, the successful attack in May, for the first thing, was a very close run thing. It all hinged on one bridge, the Bailey Bridge, being built over the Rapido and getting the tanks across in time. It was all down to that. But at the same time, the weather had cleared and there was mass, you know, the air was full of Allied aircraft. And they had something like 4-1 advantage in men and about 10-1 advantage in tanks. And there was one German who was taken prisoner by some young Americans. And he said, an American said, "Hey, you know, if you're so great, how come you're my prisoner, not the other way around?" And the German, who had been manning an 88 anti-tank gun, said, you know, he'd been firing and the tanks kept coming around and he kept blowing up tanks. And he said, "I ran out of shells, you didn't run out of tanks." But there's another horrible, horrible dark twist of the story, is that the idea of the Anzio breakout and the fourth battle attack was to encircle the German 10th Army, a formidable force. But Clark, because he was so obsessed with publicity, decided that he wanted to make sure that his troops were the first people into Rome, you know, the great other Axis capital. And the Germans were let, for this reason, they were allowed to escape, and they just kept fighting, and eventually they would form another line across the Alps, which was basically never really broken until the end of the war. So all of that really, you know, the plan was to destroy a large German army, and that was a failure as well. And I think the lessons of it are that it's really about sort of the political expediency and military expediency when they are very often, we see in many war, many military conflicts, they're often, you know, contradictory. And there was nowhere more so than at Cassino. Where, as I said, they, for political reasons, they had to keep attacking, even though they were attacking a pretty much, you know, impregnable position. And the other thing is, it's something interesting, like coalition warfare, and how often, you know, the mistrust at the top leads all the way down through the ranks. I mean, Clark would call the British sort of generals feather dusters and this sort of thing, and the British thought the Americans were inexperienced, and the Americans thought that the British were far too cautious and far too wary of losing lives. Because, of course, the British didn't. They were pretty low on bodies by this point of the war, unlike the Americans, of course. So, you know, and then there's the French that were mistrusted, the New Zealanders who were sort of autonomous, although they were supposed to be under the command of Alexander. And you've got the Indians who are sometimes turn around and say, "What on earth are we doing in Italy fighting for the British who actually oppress us in India? You know, what are we doing here?" And I think in coalition and in any war, you can have this sort of thing. The unique thing about Cassino is all of these factors came together to cause you know, it was a victory, but it was a Pyrrhic victory for the Allies. And, you know, for the people I spoke to, you know, I really based the book on interviews with hundreds of veterans. I traveled all the way around the States, all the way around Britain. I had researchers in Germany, France, New Zealand, and all of them have this feeling, not of pride in having fought on the right side in this good war, but just sadness and regret and anger that they were put through what they were put through in those mountain conditions.
So I hope you enjoyed that interview with Matthew Parker. I always enjoy doing interviews with a wide variety of people. And I think to give my final thoughts on this three-part series and the war in Italy in general, I think it's always going to be one of those controversial campaigns, mainly because Italy was so mountainous and had so much defensible terrain that it just seemed, from a tactical and strategic perspective, just unrealistic and kind of a waste of time and resources. But going back all the way to the first episode, when we talked about the wider strategic problem of the war, which was that the Soviet Union was fighting the Germans pretty much all by themselves, and there was no other fighting going on elsewhere. So the Allies didn't really have a whole lot of other options. And considering, again, in 1943 and early 1944, the Allies weren't ready for a cross-channel invasion. Although the U.S. was advocating for that, I think the British and a lot of the other Allies understood that if they were going to do this, it had to succeed. It could not fail. I think in Rick Atkinson's book, who's written about the Western Front in particular, and when it comes to Italy, he kind of wrote that, if not Italy, then where? If not, for the cross-channel invasion, they could have gone to Greece or, somewhere else in the Balkans. But again, Italy just seemed the most feasible and the most politically sound area. And I think just to reiterate again, just as the fighting shifted elsewhere, in the war in 1944-1945, the Italian campaign kind of became a backwater. Even after the fall of Rome in June 5th, most people forgot about it. And it was mostly kind of not necessarily second-rate units, but it was kind of a hodgepodge of units that were fighting there kind of by the end of the war. And this kind of included the 92nd Infantry Division, which was segregated African-American division. You had Japanese-Americans, you had Brazilians, you had South Africans. So again, I think one of the constant themes throughout the Italian campaign is that it's sort of kind of a microcosm of all of the kind of allied forces that were ultimately fighting in the war, kind of, again, ranging from New Zealand, the Poland, to Great Britain, to France, to the United States. So again, it was just kind of a remarkable effort to think about it. I think one of the kind of interesting parts about reading about the war in particular was when both the Germans and Japanese in particular talked about the Americans, that how could this army with people from all over the world, this kind of nation of immigrants, fight this war? It just didn't seem feasible, and they did. And although unfortunately segregation existed and there were still prejudices that Japanese Americans being interned, they still fought with tremendous courage and valor. And I think that definitely needs to be acknowledged. And then again, as for a lot of the experiences of Poland and the New Zealanders who fought there, I think, again, it's just kind of a unique part of the war that, again, you had this such a wide variety of blend of people that came from all over the world to fight in this the last sort of great war, as they describe it. Is ultimately, I think Italy was important. I think that it was important that Italy was knocked out of the war. I think it did contribute to tying down German forces in Italy to prevent them from going elsewhere. Although it was long, it was hard, it was attritional, I think it played an important role. And although it probably will continue to be controversial, I think it's important to kind of look at the Italian campaign Just because, again, I think it's often overlooked. And I think some of those early battles were really important, especially for the U.S., that, you know, just from learning from a tactical perspective, from a logistical perspective, from a strategic perspective, I think there were a lot of lessons that were learned and, you know, applied to the later battles that would be pretty important to the war. So that's kind of my two cents on, you know, the war in Italy. There's a tremendous amount of literature and books about it. The best one would probably be Rick Atkinson's book, in my opinion. But all the authors I interviewed, their books are also great. They kind of look at the battle specifically, and Rick Atkinson kind of looks at it from, you know, pretty much from the moment of Operation Husky up until the taking of Rome on June 5th. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. I definitely encourage you to read more about it. Again, I think it's just one of those, it's kind of one of the unique parts of World War II that often gets overlooked. So I hope you enjoyed the three-part series. I hope you learned a lot, and we'll have more episodes coming out over the next couple weeks.